the trial of Karen Reed for the death of her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, is underway.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
The first week of testimony has come to an end.
It's a spectacle. That's for sure.
We really heard the defense highlight some of the discrepancies between what was documented and what first responders said they remembered.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
The fact that the investigation wasn't thorough provides a big wrinkle in the prosecution's case.
They're supposed to be creating this reasonable doubt, and they're doing exactly that.
Everybody wants to know, us included, why he wouldn't go inside that home on the night that the body was discovered.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
It's always the theories or stories that each side will put forth, right, for a jury to listen to and decide which one is more believable.
We asked Karen Reed about that alleged confession.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him? I hit him.
I did not.
When the FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder, that never, ever happens.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
Defense attorneys learn in school, first class, the most important thing you can do is identify and select stupid juries.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
Karen Reed is facing up to life in prison.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
The trial of Karen Reed is moving along. We now have heard from more than 50 witnesses over the course of 6 weeks. Names that we've heard over and over, names that are crucial to understanding the theories of what happened, are finally being called by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to give testimony into what they may know about the death of Officer John O'Keefe. We are finally getting to hear from some of the experts, some of the state police, John's niece and nephew, and some of the Canton public workers. But before all of that, one of the most anticipated witnesses took the stand on day 17 and 18. We finally heard from Brian Higgins. Higgins is one of the names that we have heard repeatedly. He was present that night at Waterfall and at 34 Fairview. He and Karen shared flirty texts over the course of a couple of weeks when things got rocky with John, and we've heard all about him getting rid of his phone on a military base around the time that the phone preservation orders were signed by the court. I don't know exactly what I was expecting with Higgins, but whatever it was, I don't think that what I was expecting was what we got. I'm not going to spend too much time going over Higgins' background because I've introduced this in a previous episode, but I want to point out that he does have an extensive background in law enforcement, military, and as a firefighter and first responder. After the tragic death of his sister, Canton Police Chief Berkowitz offered Higgins a space at the Canton Police Department to use as an office, though he was actually an ATF agent. During cross-examination, attorney Alan Jackson points out that Higgins has full access to Canton Police Department solely based on his friendship and relationship with Chief Berkowitz. Jackson says that Higgins' closest friends are some of the most powerful people in Canton in terms of politics and law enforcement. He even brings up a toast that Higgins made at Berkowitz' retirement party, where Higgins says, quote, "If you want to hide a body, Ken Berkowitz is your man," end quote. Higgins, Brian Albert, Kevin Albert, and Eddie Hernandez all rode back to Massachusetts from New York together after the funeral of the New York City officer that they attended that January in 2022. Alan Jackson brings up a fistfight at a Christmas party between Brian Albert and Eddie Hernandez, but the objections were sustained, so we didn't hear much detail on this altercation. Jackson wants to use this as an example of what he refers to as a reputation that Brian Albert has for being a fighter. And he also points out that Higgins testified to the federal grand jury that even Chief Berkowitz was a little afraid of Brian Albert. Higgins took Brian and Eddie to get their cars when they got back from New York, and then he dropped off Kevin Albert. He swapped from the truck that he was driving over to his Jeep that's equipped with a plow, and then he went to Hillside to meet Brian Albert and get some food and drinks. The swapping of cars, as well as how many cars Higgins has, is brought up a couple of times. He has a government truck, a surveillance vehicle, and he flips between his personal Jeep and truck. Some of these cars that he keeps are at Canton Police Department, and he leaves an available key if they need to be moved to, for example, plow the parking lot if it snows. While at Hillside, Brian Higgins was drinking Jameson and ginger. That's his drink. And Brian Albert told him that he was going to be going to Waterfall to meet up with his family and friends. So he invited Higgins to come along. Higgins estimated that they were at Hillside for an hour or so. And he said that Brian Albert left about 15 minutes before he did. He estimated that he arrived to Waterfall around 9 p.m. Higgins describes his relationship with Brian Albert about the same way that Brian Albert described it. They were co-workers, but they've gotten closer in recent years, becoming friends and hanging out socially. While at Waterfall, Higgins said that he saw the defendant and John O'Keefe walk in. And Higgins actually referred to Karen as the defendant, which was interesting given the familiarity between them. I've mentioned before, referring to someone as the defendant is a way to take the emotion out of it, since it's easier for a jury to convict a nameless defendant than it is for them to convict a person with a name and friends and a family. Higgins didn't talk to Karen while she was at the Waterfall, but he said that when he left, he sent her a text that said, well, and referred to this as a flirty text. We're going to get into the flirty text more in a minute, but it gets awkward and I'm not ready to jump into that nonsense just yet. Higgins said that Brian Albert invited everyone to go back to his house, so he said he decided to go. I was very interested to hear what Higgins had to say about where he parked his Jeep. This has been one of the issues that we've had with so many of the witnesses' conflicting statements. Where did Higgins park? He says that when he got to Fairview, he was being a quote-unquote smartass and decided to use his plow to do a sweep of the driveway, though the snow wasn't really accumulating yet. After he pulled in the driveway and did this, he said that he pulled out and he parked in front of the mailbox with the rear of his Jeep backed up to the edge of the driveway. Now, this is the same spot that Matt and Jen McCabe said that they saw his Jeep, but also it's the same spot that everyone else who pulled up in that truck said that was definitely empty. I don't know. I'm still not quite sure what to make of that. I don't know how some people can be so sure that the Jeep was there and other people can be so sure that it wasn't. Higgins went in the side door and he said that he hung out for a while, but he didn't stay long because all they had to drink was beer and he's a whiskey guy. He looked at pictures with Brian Albert of his son, who was in the Marines, since Higgins and Brian Albert also both served in the Marine Corps, but he said that they were only in the other room briefly. Higgins contradicted Brian Albert's testimony that they went upstairs to look at pictures in his son's room, though. He said that he had never been upstairs at any time in Brian Albert's home. He also said that he never went to the basement that day, but he had been in the basement before. There was a moment during cross-examination where Alan Jackson brought up Brian Albert saying that he and Higgins walked, quote-unquote, upstairs, and Jackson was trying to ask Higgins, if you've never been to the third floor of their house, but y'all walked upstairs, that would mean that the testimony about walking upstairs would have put you in the basement, walking upstairs back to the main floor. But Higgins doesn't really pick up what Jackson is trying to ask, and Jackson is limited on the form of how he can ask it, so he never really is able to get the answer out of Higgins that he wants, but I think that the jury understood where he was going with it. Something that was pretty major that came up during cross-examination is the description that Higgins had given of a male who apparently entered 34 Fairview after they returned there from the bar. Now, we've heard pretty much the same story with some varying or conflicting details from each witness, but the overall story has been mostly the same, at least about who was at the house. But this is the first that we've heard about a tall, dark-haired male entering the house.
Now, You do recall giving testimony at another proceeding on June 1st, 2023, correct?
Yes.
And of course, the same thing applied. You were under oath. Is that right?
Yes.
You knew that it was a crime to lie under oath?
Yes.
In that proceeding? During the course of that proceeding, you were asked who was in the house and who you saw come into the house, correct?
Yes.
And during the course of that testimony, you admitted that you observed a tall, dark-haired male enter the Albert house that night, correct?
I believe that was in reference to ask to somebody's brother in a pickup. I don't know if that was during...
All I'm asking you, Mr. Higgins, is did you say that? Did you say a tall, dark-haired male entered the house while you were there?
I said they might have.
Did you say they might have?
Yes.
Higgins testified that he wasn't really paying close attention, but there was a tall male that he didn't know who entered the house briefly. Jackson asked about him giving this statement to the Massachusetts State Police, but Higgins said he doesn't recall, and he also didn't mention this person to Lally when he was asked about who was in the house. The first thought that I had would be Julie Nagel's brother, but he never entered the house, and he's not a tall, dark-haired man. John O'Keefe is tall, but Higgins knows him. Colin Albert was tall, and Higgins said that he didn't think that he would be able to pick Colin out of a lineup, so maybe Colin? It's another question that we're left with. Higgins said that he never saw John or Karen enter the house, but he said that he did send a text to John while he was at the house asking where John was or if he was coming. Higgins said that he was actually the first person to leave the house, and while he doesn't remember specifically what Colin looked like, he said that he never saw him. We know from testimony that Higgins actually arrived before everyone else. Remember that whole sweep the driveway thing? And we know that Caitlin, Nicole, and Brian Albert all saw Colin, but somehow Higgins said he didn't. He didn't stay long, he said. Remember, they only had beer. And when he left, he said that he went out the breezeway or the middle door. He said that he got in his Jeep and moved just a few feet, but he heard the plow grinding, so he lifted it up about a foot or two and then drove away. He doesn't remember seeing anything that concerned him, no tire tracks and definitely no body in the yard right in front of where he parked or where he drove by to leave. Higgins said that when he left, he knew that he had to go by Canton Police Department to move the cars before the snow came so that the parking lot could be plowed. Otherwise, he said he would have to wake up really early to go do it the next morning. He has a key card to get into the Canton Police Department, so he parks in the back and he cuts through the Sallyport to get to the station. Now, this is a Sallyport that we're going to hear a lot about in the next episode or two, or three. Higgins describes it as pretty small, maybe 12 feet long, to get from one side where he enters the door to the other side. Dispatch is off to the right side. There's like a wooden door with glass panels, and he saw Sergeant Good when he went in. Now, Higgins said that he went up to his office, he got the keys for the cars, and went downstairs and moved two cars to the center of the parking lot. And then he left Canton Police Department in his Jeep to go back to his home in West Roxbury. He estimated getting home around 1:30 or 2. We know it couldn't have been 1:30 because that's what time he got to Canton Police Department. He ate some food, he put his phones on the bedside table, and he went to sleep. Higgins said that he woke up the next morning to his phone blowing up around 6:30 a.m., first was a call from Chief Berkowitz, which he said he didn't answer, and the next call was from Brian Albert. Higgins said he did not talk to Brian Albert any time between when he left his house and that first early morning phone call. He denies those conversations at 2:22 a.m. More butt dials, which, of course, was addressed on cross-examination.
Your testimony previously was at some point before 7 a.m., that call was the one that woke you up.
Yes.
And it turns out, Mr. Higgins, that was a lie, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't a lie.
When you were asked that question at a previous hearing, you didn't know that the person questioning you had your phone records, did you?
I assume they did.
And you were thereafter confronted with those phone records, correct?
I was asked about them, yes.
And those phone records established that you and Brian Albert actually exchanged not one, but two phone calls at 2:22 a.m. that morning at a time when you claimed you were in bed asleep, correct?
I have no recollection of any phone calls.
These were the records that were shown to you at a prior hearing?
Yes.
And you acknowledge that at least the one marked QQ is a record of your calls, correct?
It has my name, my telephone number, correct.
And it indicates that on January 29th, 2022, at 2:22 and 35 seconds, you received a call from Brian Albert, duration of 1 second, correct?
Yes.
In other words, Brian Albert called you at 2:22 and 35 seconds, but it looks like you missed the call, correct?
I see the 1 second call, yes.
There's a second call just below that. On the same date at 2:22 and 52 seconds, from you to Brian Albert. Do you see that one?
Yes.
And the duration of that call is 22 seconds, correct?
I see that, yes.
So 17 seconds after you missed a call, according to these records, from Brian Albert, you called him back, and there was a call lasting 22 seconds. Is that right?
That's what the records say.
May I approach?
Yes.
So the fact is, you were speaking to Brian Albert in the middle of the night, approximately 3 hours before Mr. O'Keefe's body was found in his yard, correct?
No, that's not correct.
And that was 5 minutes before 2:27 a.m. when there was a Google search for how long to die in the cold, correct?
Objection.
Sustained.
And then, of course, you lied about that under oath in that prior proceeding by saying, I don't remember this phone call.
Objection.
Sustained.
Did you, in fact, tell the truth at the prior proceeding when you said, I don't remember that phone call?
I always tell the truth.
Did you lie under oath, sir?
No, I did not.
Would you tell us if you did?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Higgins says that he doesn't think that 22 seconds is long enough to have a conversation of substance with anyone. But he also has a possible explanation.
Now, when you were asked about this, and you were shown these records at prior hearing, you had an explanation for what that 22-second call may have been and what the prior call may have been, correct?
Yes.
What was your explanation?
Well, I used a phrase that people commonly used as a butt dial.
So you think it's possible that you may have butt dialed Brian Albert for a 22-second call that you're not aware of?
I think it's possible that he could have been inadvertently called back, but I have no recollection of that, nor did I have any conversation with anybody.
How are we back here with more butt dials in this trial? I still don't understand. Jackson goes through some of the same line of questioning with these butt dials as he has with all of the others, having to unlock the phone with facial recognition or a passcode, dial a number or choose a contact or a recent call, etc., etc. And he verifies that Higgins lived alone. He has Higgins read his previous grand jury testimony that says that when he got the call from Brian Albert, he called him back. And it's possible that the phone picked up on the other end and Higgins terminated the call, which this is, of course, different than what he's testifying to today. Higgins says, regardless, there was no conversation with Brian Albert at 2:22 a.m. Higgins said that he went to Brian Albert's house that next morning after getting that call. He can't remember where he parked or how many police cars were there or anything like that, but he said that he does remember seeing Brian and Nicole and Jen and Matt, plus Brian Jr. popping in at some point and Julie Albert stopping by with donuts. Higgins said that when he heard about John O'Keefe being found on the lawn, that didn't make sense to him because he said that John and the defendant never showed up. Higgins said that he didn't stay at Fairview long, maybe less than an hour, and he can't remember if he went to the police station or back home after that. He was still upset and trying to put things together, and he said that he knows he was at the police station at some point that day, but he just can't remember when. Jackson says, based on the key card swipes, records indicate that Higgins was at Canton Police Department from around 9 a.m. until 5 p.m., closer to 6, and we hear about key card swipes throughout the day. There's also a 12-minute phone call between Higgins and Kevin Albert from Canton Police Department. Jackson asks Higgins if Kevin was providing him with information about the death of Officer O'Keefe, or if Higgins was providing information to Kevin that he was receiving while at Canton Police Department. Higgins said absolutely not. There are a lot of key card swipes for Higgins in the Sallyport area, and Jackson points out that this is the same area where Karen's car was taken. But he also asked Higgins about the other evidence that was taken there, like the Stop and Shop bag with the Solo cups. He also points out the multiple phone calls between Higgins, Berkowitz, and Brian Albert, back to back around this time, and again asks about relaying information between them about the investigation. He brings up the key card swipes from Higgins and Berkowitz, both being swiped in the Sallyport at the same time, though Higgins said that he can't recall being in there with Berkowitz. When Jackson pushed him about this and said, "Are you saying that you weren't in there or that you don't recall?" he didn't give a definitive answer that they were not in there together, but he said that he does not recall being in there with Berkowitz. Higgins said that he met with Proctor and Bukenik, and he knew both of them, but he said that he wasn't close with either of them. There was an interesting moment in Cross when Jackson asked Higgins where he met with Proctor on February 3rd. Higgins said that he met with him in Sharon, Mass., and it wasn't at a police station, but there was an objection that was sustained, so the jury doesn't get to hear where at. Higgins said that he wanted to provide law enforcement with text threads between him and John, as well as between him and Karen Reed. He said that he wanted to be transparent, so he consulted his best friend, who is also a federal employee, and asked for the best way to do this. He ended up printing out pages of these texts and saving them on a drive. The texts are introduced into evidence, and we start with the ones between Higgins and John. We hear about Higgins going to John's house, and he texts him the next day asking about his nephew's video game controller. It was interesting because on the stand, when Higgins brought this up, he got choked up mentioning this. This is pure speculation on my part, but I couldn't help but wonder if that's because of maybe the guilt that he felt. Think about it. These kids have been through so much, and they've experienced more loss than any child should ever have to experience. On top of that, Higgins was texting Karen behind John's back. I would probably have a lot of guilt and shame in that situation as well. Higgins said that he had stopped by during a Patriots game and ended up playing video games with John's nephew. And in his text from the next day, he mentions being really hungover and asked John if he broke his nephew's controller when he threw it. I guess he felt bad. That was on January 16th, and there's a text from Higgins to John at 12:20 a.m. on January 29th after leaving the waterfall when he asked John if they're coming there to Fairview where they all were. Then we get to the text between Higgins and Karen. Warning, it's pretty cringy. On January 12th, Karen initiates the text conversation by sending a text that said, "Hey Brian, this is the Weed Whacker." Brian tells the story of how apparently he was driving down the road and Karen was in the yard using a weed whacker. He beeped the horn and Karen didn't recognize him, so she just gave him the finger. He said he turned around and when he pulled up to where she was and began rolling down the window, she started to yell at him to get the hell away from her because her husband is a Boston cop. Higgins said that when he rolled down the window a little bit more, then she recognized him. It became a joke and apparently that became her nickname. Karen got Higgins' number from a mutual friend and texted him. They talked back and forth, but the text only ranged from January 12th to the 23rd, so only about 9 or 10 days, and they aren't consistent daily. Karen mentions planning a short vacation with John and some friends, and she asks Higgins if he would want to come. And Higgins tells her that he's going to Nashville for a benefit and tells Karen that they should come. Karen said that she feels like she relates to Higgins because he's kind of a loner, which she used to be. The texts get flirtier as they are both kind of testing the water, and Higgins tells Karen that she's trouble. Karen tells Higgins that she thinks he's hot. You can tell that he's not expecting this, but he's obviously into it. He tells her that the feeling is mutual and says that she's hot and smart and witty. He asks her how long she's thought that he was hot and what she likes about him and if she was happy or not, and what she wants from him, telling her that the ball is in her court. Karen isn't always quick to respond, so there are a few times when he comments that she's leaving him hanging, or he asks, now what, and pushes to know what she wants from him. He also says a few times that he thinks that she's just messing with him, and he wants to know if she's serious. One thing that stood out to me about these texts is Karen's desire to connect. I've heard for so long that she was an outsider with John's friends, not a part of the group. And you can definitely hear that as each one of them has testified about her. She makes a few comments to Higgins that seem to show a desire to be connected or to relate on some level. Maybe not to be an outsider. She mentions that he seemed to be a loner like she used to be. And she said that she thinks that they're a lot alike. And she said that she felt like they were just from the same neighborhood. And she says that they're both single with no kids and nothing tying them down. Higgins mentioned that John had invited him to watch the Patriots game at the house and said that he hadn't answered yet because he didn't want to intrude on their couples night. She tells him that he should come. They like hanging out with non-couples. She said that most couples don't like hanging out with other couples anyway. A lot of the flirty texts actually take place the night of the game, when Higgins is at John's house and after he went home, when Karen was apparently awake in bed and they were texting. There are periods of time where they don't talk, and we will hear that she actually stopped by his house during that 9 or 10 day period briefly, but it was apparently awkward and they didn't even finish one drink. And then the texts on the 23rd actually include Higgins calling Karen stranger and saying that he hasn't heard from her, and mentioned thinking that she didn't want to talk to him anymore. But the texts that they do have for that week and a half include some comments that seem to show the frustration that Karen was feeling in her relationship, some of the first real glimpses at the issues between her and John, and the difficulties that she was having being a blended family with John and his niece and his nephew. Karen said that she was happy in her relationship, but things had deteriorated.
Defendant responded, "It is very, very complicated. He and I dated when we were kids, and then his sister died and everything got fucked up." I responded, "He seems very into you."
Higgins asked Karen if she and John are breaking up or staying together.
Defendant responded, "I don't know. He hooked up with another girl on vacation. I'm very close to his niece. It is a very fucked up situation." I responded, "When was that and how did you find out he hooked up? ? I don't want to complicate your situation." Defendant responded, We went away for New Year's, the four of us. I put the kids to bed and found him in the lobby of our hotel all over one of our friends. Whatever, it doesn't matter." I responded, "It does matter."
Higgins says that there was one night during this short time period that Karen stopped by his house, and they had a conversation where he said that he was trying to figure out what it was that was happening between them. That was the night that he said that it was awkward and they didn't even finish one drink.
So there was an occasion that the defendant stopped at my house, and again, the conversation that took place at my house was in relation to, again, sussing out and trying to figure out if this was everything that I stated before, like, was this legitimate? Was she seriously interested in me? Was she at the end of her relationship with John? And during that, there was touch on that topic, and I became to realize, it was my understanding at that point that this incident took place in Aruba on New Year's Eve, based off the text messages and the conversation at my residence.
This was something that she brought up, not only in the text communications with you, but in person in communication with you as well.
Yes. I mean, outside of being over there for the game, there was only one time that the defendant and I ever interacted on a one-on-one basis.
Higgins said that when he left John's house after that football game, Karen walked him out and she surprised him by planting a kiss on him. Karen brings this up in those texts also, saying that John showed her the ring video of her walking Higgins out and asked if they were hooking up now. Again, Higgins pushes to get an answer out of what Karen wants from him. What, if anything, she's looking for. She turns it around and asks him what he wants, and Higgins responds, the real deal. Karen tells him that doesn't exist. Higgins pushes her again, asking her who and what she wants.
Defendant responds, I then said, do you even know what you want, question mark, or who, question mark. Defendant responded, because I went from being solo to trying to give attention to kids who aren't mine, and I never wanted kids. I responded, I thought you were in this happy relationship. Defendant responded, everyone is happy at the hillside. I responded, oh God, you avoid things. Defendant responded, it's just very, very complicated dynamic with the four of us. He isn't cut out for what he's doing, and the kids present constant issues. I responded, I think he believes he is doing the right thing. Defendant responded, well, of course he is, but his heart isn't in it. It's only because he was very, very close to his sister. I responded back, I know how you feel, kinda. I was married, and when I met her, she had a 2.5-year-old. I went from being single to being a dad. It's hard. Then I said, I'm divorced since 2017 and have no kids. Defendant responded, I try very hard, but they are very spoiled, and they're not my family. My parents keep telling me I'd feel differently if they were mine or my own sisters. Then I told you he got drunk and sloppy on NYE while we were away, and that has really affected me. I responded, what did he exactly do? Question mark. Defendant responded, I never got married, and now somehow I'm arguing W someone about raising kids with an emoji. I responded, why don't you tell me? Question mark. Defendant responded, he was a puddle all day and then disappeared. Then I found him all over our friend's sister in the lobby of our hotel, and she's gross, which I think may actually be worse. Not sure. I responded, oh God, did they bang? Defendant said, so I was the kid celebrating New Year's, W, I think it's without him, which shouldn't be my role. No, I doubt it. He was a mess. I said, was it the first time with her, or do you think there were others? Defendant responded, I don't really think there were others. I'm with him all the time. He never seems to want to go anywhere, without me. But honestly, the issues with the kids bother me more than him actually cheating. They are constant, and it feels like a lose-lose. I responded, you clearly have a lot of feelings swirling inside you. Defendant responded, yeah, it's very complicated. Sorry for the rant. I responded, or began to respond, you can vent, babe. Basically, I just feel like I spread myself too thin, and sometimes it's thankless. I responded, Defendant responded, you probably felt that way too. I responded, I did at times. It was one, not two, thankfully. Defendant responded, want to grab a drink? Question mark. I responded, if you gave me some notice, I could have. Defendant responded, you in capital letters said you were adaptable. I responded, I am, but I have my work truck with me and not my personal. Do you get angry when you don't get your way? Defendant responded, that sounds like an excuse. I rarely get my way.
They chat back and forth, but they don't end up meeting up. They discuss why it probably would have been a bad idea anyway.
I responded, coming to your house would have been bad for the both of us. For starters, you wouldn't have wanted me to leave. Defendant responded, that sounds good. I responded, that's trouble. Defendant said, why? Question mark. The defendant said, no, I'm busting your chops. It's okay. I responded, no, you are sensitive. Nice try. You don't think if I came over for a drink, we would have gotten carried away. Defendant said, you in capital letters said you were adaptable and tons of fun. I took that as an invite for an invite. And I responded, oh, okay. Defendant responded, I'm 42. I know what happens when you invite someone over for a drink. I responded, you're the master of avoidance, so you think I would just give it up. Defendant responded, I've been a lot in my life. I have a little bit of cop DM mindset, and then said, been through.
The carp DM mindset is supposed to be carpe diem mindset. They continue.
Defendant said, what am I avoiding? ? I'm not afraid to be direct. I responded, some of my questions. Defendant responded, okay, which? Ask again. I said, nope, tricks are for kids. Defendant responded, I'm pretty sure we would have hooked up. I responded, okay. Defendant said, I can't say that? ? I said, of course you can. Defendant said, did I miss any other questions, sir? ? Probably. Are you having a drink right now? ? Defendant said, yeah, on my second. I said, show me what you got. Defendant said, none of that is true! ! I'm not talking to other guys, and I have issues with John, and things are far from perfect. You just happen to know about him, BC, I guess, because we all hang out at the same bar. I'm sure you talk to other girls. That's what single people do. I'm not married. Neither are you. Neither is John. I responded, was that your attempt at a lecture or deductive reasoning? ? What do you want from me? ? Defendant said, that's just how I think/feel. You don't need to approve. I've already answered that last question a couple of times, I think. I responded, I'm not judging you. Never have, never will. Defendant responded, you shouldn't. I don't know what your private life is about, nor is it my business. Defendant said, I'm assuming point is that there's a difference between being married to someone and dating them, and we have no intention of ever getting married. The point of dating is not to get tied down if you're not confident you should be, in my mind anyway. The first two, but I don't care too much about the other girl. I responded, okay, so he is cool with you dating other people? ? Defendant responded, and I'm not I happy per se, just realistic that there's cracks and it's far from perfect. I doubt it. If he's seeing someone else, I wouldn't want to know either way. He probably feels the same way, and you probably feel that way about whoever you hook up with. I think that's normal. I responded, okay. Defendant said, you don't agree with me? ? Defendant said, at a bar? ? I responded, I wasn't suggesting anytime soon. I know you're with your friend. I meant my house. Probably after 8. Defendant said, probably after 8. I responded, okay, if you don't want wanna, that's fine. No pressure. Defendant responded, I will a drink. It looks like I tabbed the bubble with a ? I then said, what do you drink? ? Are you out now? ? Defendant responded, sorry, I'll drink whiskey if that's what you're having. I responded, haha, send me a pic of you two.
Higgins said that he isn't proud of these texts. It is what it is, and he takes responsibility for them. He said that John was a friend, and he thought that maybe John and Karen were at the end of their relationship. He thought that he could have something with Karen. Jackson points out how noncommittal Karen was when Higgins was wanting clarification from her on what she may want from him. And Higgins seems to want to avoid answering about whether or not he had a romantic interest in Karen.
She said something along the lines of, I'm just trying to be realistic. There's cracks in the relationship. It's far from perfect. Is that right?
I think that's something she texted.
All right. And you'll agree that during the course of these texts, you were constantly asking for clarity and explanation from her, were you not?
During our communication, I did ask for clarity.
Many times.
Yes.
You saw it, correct?
Yes.
And she pretty much wouldn't answer you, correct?
She was noncommittal, I would say.
Which is why you were saying in your texts, why won't you answer the question? And she would parry and not answer that one either, correct?
Well, I didn't want to be stuck in the middle of anything.
That's not my question. I'm asking you whether or not she would answer your question about clarity specifically.
She avoided questions about text.
Right. And that was frustrating because you were very interested in her romantically at that point, correct?
I was attracted to her. I don't know that I would say very interested in her.
You texted things like, why did you get my number and reach out? That's a quote from the text we just read, correct?
I did ask that, yes.
You said, now what? Is that right?
Yes.
You texted, so now what? Correct?
Yes.
You texted, I would hang out, meaning with you?
Yes.
Correct? You were showing interest in her?
Yes.
You were showing romantic interest in her?
I wouldn't say it was romantic. I was trying to vet it out.
Well, you weren't seeing if she wanted to go see a ball game with you as a buddy, right?
Not really, no.
No, you were showing romantic interest in her, weren't you?
I was trying to vet out what was her interest in me legitimate. It was very normal for me to have that question in my mind when I didn't initiate this, she did. And I think it was a fair question just to try to find out.
You were showing romantic interest in Karen Reed, weren't you?
I was interested, but I don't think I was at the romantic phase.
Okay. When I say romantic, well, what do you mean by romantic? What's the romantic phase?
Sending somebody flowers?
Dating?
Well, there's a difference between dating and hanging out. I mean, it's kind of hard to date somebody when you have a boyfriend.
Mr. Higgins, well, not if both people are dating other people, right? Happens all the time, doesn't it?
Well, I think I asked that question, too.
Right. That's not my question. My question is, you seem to have a problem admitting that you had a romantic interest in my client. Is there a reason for that?
I was attracted to her.
Right. Physically attracted.
I thought she was an attractive woman.
Romantically attractive.
I'm not going to go there. No, I don't agree with that.
Of course you're not going to go there, because that would put you in a very awkward position, wouldn't it, sir?
Objection.
Not at all.
So the objection sustained is to the form. You can ask it differently, and that answer will be stricken now.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. May I?
Yes.
You were sexually attracted to her.
I was physically attracted to her, yes.
Sexually attracted to her was my question.
Well, I think in the text I said you're hot.
Okay. So my question again, Mr. Higgins, you seem to not want to answer my question. My question is, were you or were you not sexually attracted to my client?
Yes.
Okay. You were saying things like, what do you want from me? And I want the real deal. Those are your words, correct?
Yes.
And the real deal with you would be to date her, to get involved with her, romantically, correct?
No.
The real deal was what? What did you mean by I want the real deal?
Like a relationship.
What kind of relationship? A buddy-buddy relationship? You just want to go like...
This is the same thing everybody wants, a real relationship.
Like a romantic relationship, Mr. Higgins?
It's possible.
Right.
Aside from the one kiss that he described in the text as a peck kiss, they never had any sort of physical contact with one another. No hugs, no kisses, no sexual contact. They hadn't been talking anymore when he actually ran into them that night at the waterfall. And that's when he sent Karen that text that said, well? He said that John came in and greeted him when they arrived at waterfall, but he and Karen never interacted.
He greeted you indicated, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
Karen walked in with him?
Yes.
But she did not greet you, did she?
I think they kind of went like that, different directions.
Right.
Yes.
Did she greet you?
No.
Right. So she walked over toward the corner of the bar, and John came over and greeted you, and then walked over and joined her, correct?
Yes.
Karen didn't stop what she was doing once she was over in the corner of the bar and come over and say hi to you?
I didn't have any interaction with her that night, no.
So safe to say that throughout that evening, once she was sidled up next to John O'Keefe or friends that she was with, she never turned back around and came over and even acknowledged you, correct?
That's correct.
So she basically ignored you the entire evening.
That's not how I interpret it, no.
I didn't ask you how you interpreted it. I asked you what she did. Did she ignore you or did she pay attention to you?
Objection.
You can go ahead and answer that. Did she ignore you?
No.
So she paid attention to you? Came over and said hello, shook your hand, gave you a hug?
Well, just because somebody didn't come over doesn't mean they ignored you.
Did she do those three things?
Hug? What was the other
thing?
Say
hello, shake your hand, give you a hug?
No, she did not.
No, she didn't do any of those things, did she?
No.
It's like you didn't even exist.
I think that's dramatic. No, I don't look at it that way.
Did she ignore you or not?
No, she did not ignore me.
So she, what did she do to not ignore you?
She was working.
What direction with you?
Can I answer now?
Sure.
She, in my opinion, she was working the room, talking to people, saying hello, catching up.
Right. The one person she didn't come over to talk to and say hello to and catch up with is you. Correct?
Well, I don't know that I was the only person, but I was one of the people that she didn't say hello to, yes.
Treated you sort of like a stranger.
I don't feel that way, no.
She actually positioned herself away from you at the other end of the table on the opposite side in the corner. Isn't that right?
I don't know where she was all night, no.
Did that upset you, that she ignored you or didn't pay attention to you?
I did not feel ignored and didn't upset me at all.
But it bothered you enough to send her a text, didn't it?
No, it was a flirtatious text. It was just, that was it.
It bothered you enough to send her a text that said, with six M's behind it.
Okay.
And, well, correct?
Well, it wasn't like that. It was, well, that's it.
Just, well, like a well in the ground.
I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think you do too, sir. You meant, well, when are you going to pay attention to me?
No, that's not correct.
Well, why are you ignoring me?
It's not correct.
Well, am I chopped liver?
Objection.
All right, that's sustained. Mr. Jackson, let's move on.
Now, with all of this going on, Higgins apparently told his boss, Kate Dowd, but he only told her about the kiss from Karen, and he says that he never told Brian Albert. These texts and Brian Higgins' phone became major points that were discussed during his testimony. The phone issue became very frustrating for a few reasons. Higgins' best friend is also a federal agent with the ATF. Higgins said that he went to him to get the text off of his phone because he wanted to be transparent in what had happened. So Higgins took his phone to his friend at the Regional Computer Forensics Lab where his friend worked, and Higgins asked him to help him get these texts off of his phone as opposed to, I guess, providing his phone to law enforcement for them to create the digital image. Now, this testimony is all happening at the very end of the day, and this is after Higgins had been up on the stand all day long. The energy seems to kind of shift, and suddenly it seems like something's up. Jackson continues his questioning by asking Higgins about hooking his phone up to extract these messages that he had chosen. Jackson says that that was a federal resource, not for anything having to do with any official case that Higgins or his friend were working. Then I realize why the energy shifted. You aren't allowed to utilize federal resources for personal gain. The questioning continues briefly, and then an objection is sustained, and the jury is removed from the room, and Higgins' attorney is brought in to consult him. Jackson explains to the judge and Higgins' attorney what questions he's planning to ask, and Higgins is given a chance to discuss this with his lawyer about whether or not he will answer these questions.
The witness has indicated that he utilized federal resources for personal gain. The specifics of that testimony have been as follows. He indicated that he contacted Matt Kelch, a federal agent. He indicated that he utilized a federal facility. He called it an unsecure facility, but it's federal facility notwithstanding. And that the two of them, he and Agent Kelch, utilized federal resources in the form of some kind of a machine, as the witness indicated, for his own personal gain, so that he could, as a witness, in no official capacity, work in any official case, and in Matt Kelch's capacity as an individual rather than an agent, they both work together to download certain information from the witness's phone in anticipation of turning that highly selected, highly curated information over to law enforcement so that he could later ultimately destroy his phone, which this witness in fact did.
Okay, so it's not entirely, I disagree with you. I don't think it's reached that level. His testimony was that he went to a kiosk on the first floor where all local police departments can go. It's unrestricted. It's on the first floor. And we just got to the part about a machine in the kiosk when you mentioned an FBI resource. So what is your question? What questions do you intend to ask this witness now?
Whether he's aware that under 5 CFR 2635.702, it is a federal offense to use his public to use any public office for his own private gain or for the gain of persons or organizations with which you are associated personally. In other words, an FBI agent or an ATF agent cannot use federal resources for personal gain. The fact that he contacted an ATF agent, the fact that he utilized a facility that is owned by the federal government, run by the federal government, paid for by taxpayer dollars, and the fact that he used a machine that is owned by the federal government to download certain information for his own personal gain, that personal gain being, these are the curated texts that I'm going to turn over to law enforcement, that's a federal offense.
The jury is brought back in, and Jackson begins questioning Higgins.
You're aware, sir, that under 5 CFR 2635.702, you may not use your public office for your own personal or private gain or for the gain of persons or organizations with which you are associated personally under pain of a federal offense, correct?
Objection.
No, Your Honor. Are you aware that under 5 CFR 2634.704, it's a felony to quote...
Objection, Your Honor, as to reading.
Go ahead and finish the question.
For an employee, an employee has a duty to preserve and conserve government property and shall not use such property or allow its use for other than authorized purposes. Were you aware of that federal regulation?
That objection sustained.
Sir, notwithstanding those regulations, you utilized the services of Matt Kelch as a friend and a colleague, but utilizing federal resources to pull information off your phone, correct?
Objection.
Sustained as to that form.
In fact, you were successful in getting information off your phone, which is the text that you turn over to the Commonwealth, correct?
Objection.
In that form, you're almost there, Mr. Jackson. That form was improper.
The information that was ultimately pulled off your phone was the information that you selected and you and Matt Kelch worked together to get off your phone, correct?
Objection.
Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, if I could explain.
Sure.
He walked me through on how I could pull the text string with John O'Keefe and the defendant. He walked me through the process, how to use the machine.
And then you did that.
I did do that. That's
and
correct.
That's what you turned over to the police.
That's correct.
And any other information would still be on your phone ending in 5421, correct?
Well, that information stayed on my phone. I just took those strings off and provided them to the Mass State Police.
Okay. So where's your phone?
I do not have that phone anymore.
You've destroyed that phone, haven't you?
No, I threw the phone away.
Well, that's destroying the phone, isn't it?
I had every right to do that.
I didn't ask you about your rights.
When I threw it away, if I was going to take it out, I would break it or cut it. But I did not wipe the phone. I did not take anything else off it. But if I was going to throw the phone away, that's what I would have done.
Okay.
You know, as an ATF agent with electronic data experience, when you pull the SIM card out and break it and then throw the phone away and the SIM card away, you don't need to wipe the phone.
Objection.
Sustained.
Jackson,
that's it.
Your Honor.
One more question.
I can do this in 30 seconds, I think. You were aware that there was a court order that you not alter, delete, or destroy or in any way manipulate your phone or the electronic data associated with it, correct?
Jackson.
As to what date?
As of... September 30th, 2022.
Objection. Okay. I don't believe that's what the court order was. I think it's...
I can make a quick offer of proof. That's exactly what it was that he was notified.
Were you aware of that? Was that your understanding?
What's the question exactly, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Ask the question again.
Sure. Were you served with a copy of a notice on September 30th, 2022, that you not alter or destroy or manipulate anything on your phone on September 30th?
I was served an order, yes, that's correct.
And isn't it true, in another hearing, you explained that on September 29th, the day before you claim you got that notice, you changed phone carriers and changed phone numbers?
And I maintained the phone.
Until you didn't, when you destroyed it a month later by pulling the SIM card out and throwing it away, correct?
Objection.
Sustained.
Did you do that in October? Did you destroy that phone?
Objection.
Sustained.
Did you pull the SIM card out of your phone, Mr. Higgins?
Did you?
It's possible that I did. I believe that's how I've testified, yes.
You testified?
It's possible that if I took it out, that it was either cut or broken.
It's not just possible.
And that would have been after the date the order was already denied.
Mr. Higgins, I have one question left. One question. Did you, Mr. Lally's already standing. I haven't even started.
Have a seat, Mr. Lally. Go ahead. Last question, Mr. Jackson.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please.
Mr. Higgins, very simply, and then we're done. Did you remove the SIM card for that phone, drive onto a military base, throw the SIM card in one dumpster and the phone in a different dumpster?
That is not correct.
Did you testify that...
That was your one question, Mr. Jackson.
Is this really happening? Another phone being destroyed or gotten rid of? Higgins confirms that he was served a preservation order. And just like Brian Albert, one day before the preservation order, he changed his phone carrier and phone number. One day before. We've heard this before. It's crazy. This is crazy. We hear that Higgins testified that he did a factory reset on his phone. And we hear about him cutting the SIM card. And we hear about him throwing away his phone. And we hear about him doing all of this on a military base. A military base where law enforcement, or anyone else for that matter, can't get to it. And on top of that, Higgins testified that he didn't back up anything. No pictures, no text, nothing. It's all gone, except for what he chose to keep out to give to law enforcement. His reasoning for this is because he's single with no kids. That's not even a good excuse. Higgins says that a target that he was investigating was able to get his personal cell phone number, which is why he changed everything. And that makes a ton of sense. But the problem is that he didn't change it when that happened. He didn't change it for months. And the time that he did change it months later just happened to be the day before this preservation order? Again? How is that possible? Seeing that the phones keep coming up as missing or destroyed and traded in, and calls are made, but everyone's claiming that they were butt dials, and they're showing as answered, but nobody's saying that they answered them, and there's no voicemails. And according to the witnesses, all the police reports are wrong, but they also all have conflicting testimony. And the dog and the house and the phones have all been rehomed. And it's hard to know how many coincidences are too many before the jury thinks something doesn't sound right. The texts between Karen and Higgins don't paint either of them in a positive light. Let's be honest. Over the course of those 9 or 10 days, there were multiple days that they texted, though it wasn't daily. But they crossed some boundaries of trust, and the jury will see that. Part of me feels like Higgins really did seem remorseful about this, but another part of me can't help but wonder if that's only because he's having to answer for this on a worldwide stage, with people literally all over the world listening to his text to his friend's girlfriend. There were a lot of moments during this testimony where he seemed to be kind of in denial about wanting to push Karen for an answer. And with that level of denial, can he really be fully remorseful? True crime podcasts are generally listened to as a form of information and entertainment. But it's important to remember that this isn't regular entertainment like a movie or a TV show. This is real life. There's not a good guy and a bad guy. People are complex. Good people can do some really messed up things and make mistakes. The text between Higgins and Karen don't change all of the good that he's done in the military and the ATF and as law enforcement or first responder. But they do show a different side of him, and they will go toward his credibility with jurors. Now, how much or how little weight they give to that, it's impossible to say. It's hard to pack testimony from 2 days into 1 hour, but these were all really important things that we needed to hear about from Higgins. We still have some catching up to do, though, so you'll be getting a bonus episode again this week between now and next week's episode to catch you up on the rest of what we've heard. This trial keeps getting crazier and crazier, and we have a long way to go. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.